Good morning. This is Howell Jackson, and I'd like to welcome you to the seventh lecture in our series for the Peking University Law School. Today's lecture is on the subject of organizational structure, and in particular, we're going to be discussing the rules in the United States that govern bank holding companies and related organizations. The content of today's lecture will include a discussion of a number of important definitions in our regulatory structure, including the terms control, company, and bank, and then a discussion of one of the most important aspects of our bank holding company regulation, so-called activities restrictions, both the rules that are currently applicable in the United States and various reform proposals that are being considered by Congress at this present time. I will also discuss towards the end of the hour the financial obligations of holding companies, which is a related topic that I think may be of interest to the class. But before we turn to the primary discussion for today's lecture, I'd like to say one or two introductory comments, again, about lectures in the past few weeks. Several students have posted comments again about last week's lecture on trading lending limits, and also on the capital exercises. And what I have tried to do for each of these comments, many of which have to do with the application of the principles we've been discussing in class to the Chinese situation, what I've tried to do is post comments or reactions to the questions on the discussion groups. I very much hope other members of the class will have a chance to go through those discussion groups and read the interchanges between the students and me. And of course, if you have further thoughts about the discussion, you're definitely invited to respond to my comments or the comments of your classmates, and I will from time to time look back to the discussion groups and respond again if that seems to be called for. But I do think this is an important part of the class experience, and I would encourage all the students to both look at the discussion groups and if you have particular questions or comments at the end of each lecture, to post those on the discussion groups, and I will respond to them as best I can. Now, let's turn to the regulation of organizational structure in the United States. So far in this lecture series, we've been focusing primarily on depository institutions or banks, the entities themselves. In various situations, the entities have been owned or controlled by holding companies, but that's pretty much been in the background of our discussion so far, as has the related issue of affiliates. Let me just say a word at this point about the graphic conventions I use here. I will, for the balance of this section of the lecture series, be distinguishing between banks, which are usually shown in a pink or a reddish color, and non-bank affiliates or holding companies. Typically in the United States, these are corporations. I will show these in blue for the most part to indicate that they are not entities chartered as banks. They are ordinary corporations in the United States. They would typically be chartered in the state of Delaware, although they could be chartered in any state. And they engage in activities other than the business of banking. Now, we will discuss as we go along what kind of activities those could be, but these entities are, for the most part, less regulated. Were they not affiliated with a banking institution or other financial institution, they would not be subject to any of the specialized regulatory structures we're looking at in this lecture series. But as a result of their affiliations, they do come under a specialized regulatory system. Now, as I mentioned before, we have, for the most part, been dealing with rules that govern the banks themselves. The one exception to this point would be the insider lending rules that we looked at last week, and of course, at least some of those rules dealt with transactions between depository institutions and affiliates. In particular, Section 23A and B dealt with these kinds of transactions. But for the most part, we have been looking at rules that are focused on the bank. In particular, we initially looked at the activities that banks could undertake. We discussed a little bit about the deposits they were allowed to raise. And we talked for two lectures about the capital requirements of depository institutions. In today's lecture, we're going to broaden our horizons and take a look at the whole regulatory structure that governs both holding companies and affiliates. In the United States, that regulatory structure is generally referred to as the Bank Holding Company Act, although there are a few other relevant statutory provisions that I will discuss from time to time. The Act is relatively short. It's located in 12 U.S.C. section 1841 and the following sections. You can read the Act. It is largely reprinted, although not entirely reprinted, on pages 147 to 160 of the statutory supplement. But that is the statutory reference. That is what we will be discussing for the most part for today's lecture. Now, if you page through the statutory supplement and you look at section 1842A, which is sometimes referred to in our casebook as section 3 of the Bank Holding Company Act, you'll see the basic substantive requirement of the Act, which is it is unlawful to become a bank holding company without the prior approval of the board, which is the Federal Reserve Board, one of the federal banking agencies. What this rule establishes is that before any company can obtain an interest in a bank, which is a controlling interest, it must get the prior approval of governmental authorities. And if you look through the Act more carefully, you'll see that an existing bank holding company is also required to obtain approval before acquiring control of a second or third or fourth bank. And there is even a approval procedure that has traditionally been required when a bank holding company buys a controlling interest in a non-banking organization, a corporate affiliate of some sort engaging in some other business. So the regulatory structure for bank holding companies begins in the first instance with a prior approval procedure where the regulatory authorities undertake various examinations and review a rather extensive application to ensure that the individuals behind the bank holding company, the proposed bank holding company, and the bank holding company itself are qualified and suitable to engage in the banking business. There are a number of different aspects of this approval process, and I'd invite you, if you're interested, to read through Chapter 4, the initial pages of the casebook, which describe the process. There is, of course, a scrutiny of the qualifications of the personnel involved, a review of their background to make sure that they have both the training and the integrity to enter this area of the financial services industry. There's also a review of the financial solidity of the bank holding company and its future prospects. And then finally, there are a number of approvals that have to do with anti-competitive considerations to prevent against problems of potential monopolization or concentration of economic resources. So the approval process begins when a company proposes to acquire control of a bank. Typically, therefore, in the United States, bank acquisitions are postponed after the initial contracts are negotiated until government approval can be obtained.
For those of you who are interested in the statutory references for the approval procedures, I invite you to take a look at subsection 3C of the Bank Holding Company Act, which is located at 12 U.S.C. 1842C. The factors that the Federal Reserve Board is required to consider are right out there. Subsection 1, which I have up on the screen, deals with the anti-competitive issues, both monopolization, as you'll see in the highlighted text, and also review of transactions which might substantially lessen competition in a relevant area. And if you want to see applications of these standards, there are some illustrations in Chapter 2 of our casebook, a representative transaction or two in the antitrust section of Chapter 2 basically applies these standards. The general supervisory standards are found more in subsection 2 of the factors. And again, I've highlighted the key provisions. Financial and managerial resources have to do with the current capacity of the organization, proposed Jones would make the acquisition, future prospects of the company have to do with business plans and projections for the future of the bank holding company and the bank or banks to be acquired. And then finally, there is something called the convenience and needs of the community standard. This is actually an interesting factor that has been applied in different ways at different times in our history. Oftentimes, what this is designed to pick up is whether the acquisition will somehow disrupt the operations of the banking market based on the creation of excessive capacity. Really, what the regulators are called upon to inquire into in this instance is whether there's adequate banking in the proposed market and whether the transaction would somehow create excessive amounts of competition, potentially disruptive competition. In the United States, it's controversial whether regulatory authorities have the capacity and should engage in such inquiries, but it is formally written in the statutory structure, and at times it has been applied to prevent the creation of overbanking in certain markets. This is an issue, again, that's discussed in Chapter 2 of our casebook under the heading of chartering. And similar inquiries required from the bank's charter, and if you are interested in this kind of text, I would invite you to take a look at that section. If you look on in Section 3C of the Bank Holding Company Act, there's a final set of supervisory factors which the board is required to look into, which may be of interest. Subsection A here, I think, is fairly straightforward intuitively, which is an inquiry into whether the applicant will provide the information necessary to the board of directors. Will it supply the reports? Will it supply other background information about itself and affiliates that the board determines is appropriate? Certain corporations have reputations for being recalcitrant in turning information over to the government, and the board has the discretion to reject applicants with this kind of a piece of position on the assumption, presumably, that it will thwart the regulatory process in the future. It's not common for this provision to be invoked. I think maybe of more interest is subsection B, which deals with the special problem of foreign banks making acquisitions. And the board is given the authority here to reject an application if the foreign bank in its home market is not subject to comprehensive supervision and regulation on a consolidated basis. It's an interesting provision because it essentially applies a special test to foreign banks and bank holding companies coming into the United States, requiring the board of governors to look overseas and evaluate foreign regulatory practices. The justification for this provision is that occasionally in the United States, we've had trouble with bank holding companies located overseas that come from low regulatory, or really de facto, no regulatory system. And what this provision calls upon the board to do is to take a special look at foreign banks and their supervisory structures, typically from major industrialized countries, which is not a problem, but from tax havens and regulatory havens that do exist around the world, this provision can be used to block acquisitions from foreign banks located in those jurisdictions. Anyway, this is a quick review of the regulatory procedures that are imposed on bank holding companies who are about to make acquisitions of banks for the first time or expand their holdings of banks at a later date. And it is what might be considered the threshold regulatory process for these sorts of transactions.
I'd like to turn now to the section of the Bank Holding Company Act that defines which entities are subject to this regulatory structure we've been discussing. You'll find the key operational provision in subsection 2A of the Act, which has the definition of a bank holding company. In that provision, which is on the screen now, you'll see that any company which has control over a bank is a bank holding company. So the definition has three critical components, all of which I'd like to examine briefly in today's lecture. Sure. First, there must be a company involved. Second, it must have control. And the entity over which it has control must be a bank. As we'll see, all of these definitions have been the subject of some litigation and regulatory interpretation over the years. And we will look at all three, and in particular, the second and third elements of the test. Briefly, what I'd like to touch upon for the first element, the definition of company, is the definition itself found in Section 2B of the Act. A company, for purposes of the Bank Holding Company Act, includes more than just a simple corporation or partnership. It includes any other similar organization which can consist of a combination of individuals acting in concert in a variety of ways. The reason for this definition being larger than a mere corporation is that the regulatory structure imposed on companies is substantially more stringent than individual ownership of banking interests in the United States. This is actually an interesting regulatory decision, why we impose greater restrictions on companies than individual ownership, and that's something that's discussed from time to time in our casebook. You might want to think about why that would be. I think just to give a short answer, the reason is probably that there was a feeling that certain of the issues the Bank Holding Company Act was designed to prevent against, such as anti-competitive concerns, were more likely to be a problem when corporate control was at issue. The assumption being that if there were going to be such an amalgamation of assets as to create anti-competitive problems, it would likely take the form of corporate ownership which has a variety of tax advantages and other organizational advantages than through individual ownership. So I think that's one reason for the company requirement. And there may also be a sense that corporate owners are more likely to engage in problematic activities in terms of the exploitation of banking assets than individuals. I'm not sure that, in fact, this second assumption is an accurate one. There is reason to think that individually controlled banks get into just as much, if not more, trouble from a supervisory perspective than corporate-controlled entities, but that may have been one of the reasons underlying this regulatory structure. But the point is, having established that companies were going to have a specialized regulatory system, it was necessary to define the term company in such a way as to embrace similar economic entities that would be deployed as a substitute for companies if a definition such as this one were not employed. In the casebook, we discuss a little bit of the literature on this point, and I invite you to take a look at it if you're interested. What I want to focus on now is, I think, in some ways, a more interesting statutory element of the Bank Holding Company Act, which is the definition of control. Companies are subject to the Act only if they have controlling interests in a bank. So companies that own small amounts of bank shares, say less than 5%, would clearly not be subject to this regulatory structure. But the question is, which companies would be? And what you see up on the screen here in subsection 2A2 of the Act is an attempt to define control. Subsection A has the basic definition, which is usually the one that's at issue. When a company has more than 25% of the voting shares of a bank, it will be deemed to be in control of the bank. It can also obtain control without direct economic ownership if somehow it has the right to elect a majority of the directors, the assumption being that control over a majority of directors is de facto control over the operations of the bank. But there's also a third test, which requires an ad hoc determination by the Federal Reserve Board that the company directly or indirectly exercise a controlling influence over management and policies of the bank. So I think this third test is interesting to focus on. It gives discretion to the Federal Reserve Board, which is of interest. But more importantly, it really illustrates what the definition of control is about. It's trying to embrace all mechanisms through which an entity could influence management and policies. Because the concern about bank holding companies is they might use that influence either to exploit control over the resources of the bank through pulling out credit in some ways or gaining access to valuable economic influence of a bank through its lending policies or other economic policies, and also concern that the controlling parties might use their influence to engage in anti-competitive behavior with respect to the rest of the economy. So the Act defines a relatively open-ended standard for the board to apply, and I'd like to briefly just take a look at one illustration of the application of this latitude in one case that's in the casebook. I should note that there is a lot of law about the definition of control that doesn't come up in the case we're going to look at. There are regulatory provisions that explicate the standard quite a bit more than this simple statutory definition, and those of you who are interested should track that down. But I think a good illustration of the kinds of analysis that goes on in this area is the Sumitomo case, which I'd like to turn to now. The Sumitomo decision, which appears on page 251 of the casebook, is a transaction in which Japanese bank Sumitomo proposed to make an investment in Goldman Sachs, which has been for a number of years one of the largest investment banks in the United States. So it's a proposed investment There were concerns about the structure of the transaction, and so counsel for Sumitomo had informal discussions with the staff of the Federal Reserve Board leading up to the decision, which is summarized in the casebook on the pages indicated. Now, oftentimes, for those not familiar with the Federal Bank Holding Company structure, there's confusion about this case. Some readers assume that the decision is about Sumitomo becoming a bank holding company as a result of this transaction. That, in fact, is not the case. Goldman Sachs, though it's referred to as an investment bank, is not a bank for purposes of the Bank Holding Company Act. As we'll see later on, the Bank Holding Company Act has a definition of bank which is limited to depository institutions. That's something that Goldman Sachs is not. It's a securities firm, really. And so there's a question about why the Bank Holding Company Act even applies in this case. Well, the answer to that is Sumitomo has a controlling interest in another U.S. bank. It owned a bank in California at the time of this transaction, which made it a bank holding company for purposes of U.S. law. It was a foreign bank holding company. It's, of course, located in Japan and is itself a bank in Japan. But for U.S. regulatory purposes, it was already a bank holding company, and it was therefore subject to regulation under the Bank Holding Company statute. It is allowed in the United States to acquire other banks and also to acquire controlling interests in other affiliates that are permissible for bank holding companies in the United States. As we'll see, the requirement is that affiliates be closely related to the business of banking. Their activities must be closely related to the business of banking. Not clear entirely from this decision, but it was the fact that all parties understood that Goldman Sachs didn't fall within this definition. It engaged in all sorts of securities activities that at the time clearly would not have been considered closely related to banking. So what was at issue in the case was whether or not the Sumito investment constituted control. If there were control, then the acquisition would presumably have been prohibited because Goldman Sachs would have been engaged in activities not closely related to banking. So the whole case was really about, was there or was there not control? And of course, that meant an application of the definition in Section 2A2 of the Act, which we were discussing just a few moments ago. Did the bank holding company have a controlling interest in Goldman Sachs, or would it have as a result of this acquisition? Now, none of the obvious indicia of control were present. The transaction had been structured so that Goldman Sachs would not give a 25% voting interest to Sumitomo, nor would it have control over the election of a majority of directors or the equivalent. However, there is also this open-ended standard, which is what was really at issue in the case. Now, I invite you to read through the transaction, and in particular, the way it was initially structured. There was going to be a large investment by Sumitomo in Goldman Sachs. In fact, that was the purpose of the transaction. But it was going to be structured in a way that it was non-voting. However, as a economic matter, more than 25% of the capital in Goldman Sachs would come from Sumitomo as a result of the transaction. There were also a variety of different agreements that were part of the investment. There was some discussion about a joint venture in London and some cross investments by Goldman Sachs in Tokyo. There would be some sort of business exchanges between the firms and joint training programs. So there was not just an economic investment on the part of Sumitomo in Goldman. There was also going to be a lot of collaboration as a result of the agreement. And for all of these reasons, the Board of Governors took the view that collectively this would constitute a potentially controlling interest and therefore bring the transaction within the purview of the Bank Holding Company Act. As a result, again, if you read through this decision, what you'll see is the Federal Reserve Board required Sumitomo and Goldman Sachs to sort of cut back on the nature of their proposed relationship. The amount of investment has to be reduced so that overall it was less than 25% of the capital. The collateral agreements were required to be eliminated or substantially reduced in order to make sure that there was less substantial interaction between the two firms. Having made these adjustments, however, Sumitomo was allowed to go forward and make the investment, but just not in the form that it had originally proposed. Interesting question about this order from a matter of economic policy is whether or not it makes sense. Clearly, the board was requiring the investment to be more at arm's length. It was restricting the interactions between the two firms. Presumably, that made it less likely that Sumitomo would have a controlling influence over Goldman as a result of the investment. But it also presumably had some economic consequences. It might have been desirable for both firms to enter into the various kinds of collaborative arrangements that were being proposed. That possibility was eliminated by the board's order. The only terms under which Sumitomo could make the investment were under the restricted terms required by the Federal Reserve Board, which might have prevented or certainly did prevent certain kinds of transactions from taking place, thereby creating certain kinds of economic losses. The trade-off that is implicitly being made in this kind of an order is that it is better to forego these economic benefits for the regulatory value of keeping Goldman at arm's length. So Sumitomo is allowed to do the transaction, but only at arm's length. Goldman stays outside of the control test for purposes of the Bank Holding Company Act and economically stays at arm's length from Sumitomo as a result of the decision. In the United States, this kind of ruling is relatively common with respect to control. The Sumitomo case sort of sets up a precedent that has been followed in many other cases. If you have more of an investment, more relations than were permitted in Sumitomo, the likelihood is that you will be deemed to be in control, or at least there would be considerable concern that you would be deemed to be in control and therefore brought into the regulatory structure of the Bank Holding Company Act. Let's turn now to the third definitional provision that I mentioned, which is the definition of bank. To become a bank holding company, it is necessary to have a controlling interest in a bank. Now, you might think that of all the definitional provisions, this definition would be the easiest one to apply. But at least in the United States, that has not always been the case. For a number of years, in fact, for most of the past three decades, the definition of bank under the Bank Holding Company Act has been somewhat peculiar in its narrowness. And I put the traditional provision, which existed up until 1987 in the United States, on the board here. To be a commercial bank and a bank for purposes of the Bank Holding Company Act, an entity had to both accept demand deposits, which could be immediately withdrawn by a depositor, and also make commercial loans. Now, in certain respects, this is the classic economic definition of a bank, an entity that takes deposits and converts them into commercial loans. The problem with this definition, however, is that it made it possible for entities to create banks that were not officially banks for purposes of the Bank Holding Company Act. In fact, there was a whole era of so-called non-bank banks in the United States, which is briefly reviewed in the case book. And there were two reasons for the non-bank bank phenomenon. One was to allow commercial firms, those firms engaged in a wide range of activities, to acquire non-bank banks. They could not acquire ordinary banks because the Bank Holding Company Act would prohibit such acquisitions. The transactions were also used by regular bank holding companies to acquire non-bank banks in other parts of the country. For many years, at least up until the 1990s, in fact, the banking markets of the United States were geographically divided into states, and there were severe restrictions on bank holding companies acquiring banks in other states. Non-bank banks potentially gave them the authority to go on a nationwide basis. And in fact, one entity, known as Dimension, attempted to set up non-bank banks in every jurisdiction in the United States. So Dimension Financial, the corporation, had roughly 50 non-bank banks created, one in each jurisdiction in the United States, and they threatened to become the first bank in U.S. history, or modern U.S. history, operating in all banking markets at the same time. The Dimension case was a highly controversial case at the time. It went to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court basically upheld the applicant, Dimension Financial, and said that its proposed activities would indeed be consistent with the old Bank Holding Company Act's definition and implicitly authorized the bank to go forward. The success of the strategy depended on the particular definitions here. As a result of the Dimension case, Congress intervened in 1987 and redefined the term bank for purposes of the Bank Holding Company Act. And this new definition, which appears in subsection 2C of the Bank Holding Company Act, expands upon the traditional definition, appearing in this slide in blue, with some more definitional provisions, and in particular said that any entity that is an insured bank that has FDIC insurance shall be considered to be a bank for purposes of the Bank Holding Company Act. There are a number of other exceptions that are built into the Act, which I won't deal with here. Those of you who are interested can take a look at the statutory supplement. But what the reforms of 1987 did is to essentially broaden the definition to include any bank that has the benefits of federal deposit insurance. The way our regulatory structure is set up is that most states do not allow banks to take retail deposits, that is to collect deposits from individual customers, without FDIC insurance. And so as a result of this combination of state law and the amendment of the Bank Holding Company Act, all federally insured bank depositories are subject to this regulatory structure. It is, however, still possible to imagine banks that do not have FDIC insurance. For instance, banks that do not take retail deposits, banks that deal only with wholesale deposits, banks that fund in other ways. And the question occasionally arises in the United States is, should we subject these entities to the regulatory structure for holding companies? And there's a variety of perspectives on this issue. And I think it's an interesting one and a deep one that any regulatory system has to consider, particular one about organizational structure, which is which kinds of entities should be subjected to this regulatory system. Nowadays, there are lots of near banks being created. The internet is a pretty good example. Firms that offer payment services, firms that take funds and reinvest them in various ways, should they or should they not get this supplementary regulatory structure of holding company supervision? And this is an issue we don't have a chance to explore in an overview class such as this one, but it's one that bears thinking about. And if any of you have thoughts about the appropriate kind of definition of a bank for these purposes, I'd be happy to see your comments on the discussion group, and I would also be happy to respond to them. But now I'd like to move on and discuss some other aspects of the Bank Holding Company Act. I'd like to turn now to what may be one of the most interesting aspects of our bank holding company regulatory structure, which is the restrictions imposed on the activities of holding company affiliates. The question considered here is the kind of activities which are permissible for affiliated companies who are connected with a bank through the holding company structure. I've already alluded to the basic requirements, but I think it might be useful for me to walk through the statutory structure that establishes these requirements. And again, you need to look to your statutory supplement to see these provisions. The basic rule, as I mentioned earlier in the hour, is that bank holding companies are not allowed to acquire other corporate affiliates or become affiliated with other corporate entities unless certain conditions obtain. And Section 4 of the Bank Holding Company Act is the provision that sets forth those conditions. It appears in 12 U.S.C. 1843, beginning with subsection A, which is on the screen right now. Essentially, what this initial provision says is bank holding companies can only acquire banks or, in subsection B, corporations engaged in those activities permitted under paragraph 8 of subsection C. In the literature, this cross-reference is usually described as Section 4C8 of the Bank Holding Company Act, and it's the principal source of authority for activities of bank affiliates. There are, however, a number of permissible bank holding company investments that are contained in other provisions of Section 4 of the Bank Holding Company Act. The most important of these for comparative purposes, I think, is subsection 6, which authorizes bank holding companies to acquire voting shares up to 5% of the voting securities of any other corporation. So bank holding companies are permitted in the United States to make relatively small investments, so long as they don't get to 5% of the voting shares of corporations in those investments. And they can hold shares in a fiduciary capacity when they act as trust funds. And they're permitted to own the kinds of shares of stock that national banks themselves can own, particularly various kinds of low-risk bonds, which national banks are permitted to invest in as direct investments. But aside from these relatively narrower exceptions, bank holding companies are restricted to those kinds of investments authorized under Section 4C8. 4C8 is actually a rather complicated provision if you look at the entire text of the statutory language, but the essence of the provision is reproduced in the large letters here. Essentially, bank holding companies are permitted to acquire shares of any company that is limited to activities closely related to banking so as to be a proper incident thereto. As you'll see if you look through the casebook, the closely related to banking test is a statutory test that has been developed to define which activities are permissible. The proper incident requirement is sort of an ancillary regulatory decision that has to be made that deals with whether the activity would be convenient to the community, whether it would have significant anti-competitive effects, really a weighing of a number of factors that varies on a case-by-case basis. But the background rule is established by the so-called closely related to banking test. For those of you who are interested in this area, and there have been one or two questions in the discussion groups about the Keiretsu-style activities are permissible to bank holding companies in the United States, I would invite you to take a look at the National Courier case, which appears on page 266 to 274 of the casebook. And you'll see if you look over those pages that this was an instance in which a bank holding company in the United States had sought to get regulatory authority to engage in courier activities, which are the activities of moving materials by something like a specialized mail service or a truck service for various kinds of products. some having to do with the activities of holding companies and banks themselves, financial matters such as commercial paper and checks, which are moved around usually very quickly at the end of the business day, audit and accounting material of a financial nature having to do with business operations, and then certain kinds of non-financial materials at an unsolicited request of a third party, and as the case explains, maybe some medical products, maybe some other items that require prompt shipment could be moved in this way under a courier service operated by a bank holding company. So what happened in this case is the Federal Reserve Board concluded that indeed in its view all of these activities were closely related to banking and therefore appropriate for bank holding companies and issued a proposed regulation to that effect. And the regulation was challenged in court by, not surprisingly, a National Courier Service group that represents other firms engaged in this line of business. Presumably, their primary motivation was to protect their interests from this intrusion from bank holding companies. But the argument that they made was not that this would be bad for them, but rather that it was an impermissible activity under the Bank Holding Company Act, Section 4C8. The case itself, the National Courier case, examined the challenge by the courier companies and developed what has become the standard case law in the area for interpreting this provision. So this is an illustration of the common law at work in a regulatory field. There are some specific words in the statute that are susceptible to multiple readings, and the court offers an interpretation of those words through a test which can be applied in subsequent cases, and the National Courier test has been applied in numerous decisions over the past two decades. Essentially, what courts are called upon to do is look at the activity to see whether it's either something that banks have traditionally engaged in themselves, whether it's functionally similar to something banks have done in the past, or whether the services are so closely related to traditional bank services that they have to be provided in some sort of specialized form. These tests were applied in the National Courier case to conclude that a number of the things that the Federal Reserve Board had proposed to authorize were indeed closely related to banking under the test. Moving financial materials for banks, of course, was something that they had traditionally done. The specialized movement of related financial documents was also thought to be something similar to what banks had been doing traditionally, as to be closely enough related to satisfy the test. And in fact, the ownership of the trucks and the specialized delivery systems that went with the trucks was considered to be the sort of specialized product that it was appropriate for banks to provide both for their internal use and also, if they could do it economically, for other customers as well. So in the most part, the National Courier test generated favorable results for the banks in this particular case. However, the banks did not win on all scores, which is one of the reasons the case is an interesting teaching tool and an important precedent, because the court concluded that certain kinds of transportation services proposed to be operated by bank holding companies did not satisfy the test, and in particular, the movement of non-financial products, in particular medical products that were occasionally discussed in the case, that aspect of the proposal was deemed to be beyond the boundary of the closely related to banking test, although it was moved in the same kind of transportation vehicle. It didn't have a financial nexus, and that for the court was a determinative factor which made it just a little bit too far from the core of banking to satisfy the basic test. So I don't want to spend too much time discussing the closely related to banking test itself. Amongst other things, it's highly likely that in the United States this test will be amended, if not this year, in the next few years, to broaden somewhat the standard there are a number of proposals floating around Congress right now, which would replace the closely related to banking test with a test that's more any activity which is financial in nature. And what that means in practice is that activities such as insurance underwriting and insurance agency businesses, certain securities activities, which have so far been precluded to bank holding companies as not being closely related to banking, would become eligible activities for bank holding companies. So bank holding companies would, under the new test, be allowed to undertake any financial operation, whereas currently they're limited to a subset of financial operations, those which are closely related to banking. But whichever test is applied, the basic structure of our regulatory system is the same, that within the sphere of the bank holding company, there is allowed to be done certain financial type activities, and other activities, in particular commercial activities, are impermissible for bank holding companies. So there is a severing of the commercial side of the economy from the banking slash financial side. Now, one interesting question to consider, and one I'd like to just discuss for a moment, is what's the justification for this set of restrictions? What's the reason for this boundary on activities that limit bank affiliates to either currently businesses that are closely related to banking, or potentially in the next few years, businesses that are financial? Well, this is a question, like many questions we are considering in this lecture series, that could take a number of hours to discuss. But I think that if you looked at it carefully, you would see that there are a number of justifications. Competitive concerns are clearly a major justification. As we saw when we examined banks themselves, one of the reasons that we preclude them from engaging in other activities is concern that there would be cross-subsidization or concentration of economic resources in an unfair or inefficient manner. Some of the same concerns are present here, that banks would somehow favor their holding company affiliates, and therefore general commercial activity should not be the sort of thing that bank affiliates are permitted to engage in. There is another set of concerns, of course, related to risk, that there would be greater temptation to engage in risky activities at the holding company level if there were a wide range of activities permitted to be conducted there, and that these risks might somehow infect the banks themselves. So risks at the holding company level could be transferred down to the bank and create the sort of problems that we already discussed. One could also refer to the externalities we've discussed earlier in this lecture series. There's a potential that failure of holding companies or holding company affiliates could create systemic problems that would be unhealthy for the entire economic system. So, in short, what you see is the justifications for holding company regulation are essentially the same as the justifications for regulation of banks themselves in the first instance. We are not sufficiently satisfied that our supervision of the banking entity itself is well enough insulated from the rest of the holding company structure that we feel comfortable allowing a general latitude for holding companies and affiliates to engage in a full range of commercial activities. We think that these kinds of entities require a special form of restriction in order to safeguard the bank and indirectly our economic system. Now, it is the case that this decision to regulate holding company structure in such a stringent way is not universally endorsed by academic commentators and is not followed by all other countries in the world, even those with well-developed regulatory systems. Other regulatory systems proceed under the assumption that direct supervision of banking entities is itself sufficient, and that while it may be appropriate to monitor the business undertakings of affiliates and holding companies, there is no need for the sort of direct restrictions that you observe in the United States regulatory structure. And there are, at least according to some analysts, costs associated with the restrictions that we see in the United States, which are unnecessary. It does prevent certain kinds of affiliations and coordinated activity that may have some desirable consequences. In this hour, we discussed the case of the Goldman Sachs investment by Sumitomo. That was a transaction that was disrupted by the regulatory structure. Sumitomo was not permitted to have the kind of investment it wanted to have in Goldman Sachs, and arguably that disruption had a cost for the economy. The argument against our system of regulatory restrictions on holding company affiliates is that these costs are substantial and the regulatory gains of the restrictions are not sufficient to justify those costs. There is also at work here some potential hidden motives, and by that I mean there are some other aspects of these restrictions that might not be desirable from a public policy perspective. Many industries are protected from certain kinds of competition by the restrictions on bank holding companies. In the National Courier case, we saw the litigation was instigated by the courier companies themselves, who didn't want to face the competition from bank holding companies, and they succeeded in blocking bank holding companies from competing with them in all areas that were non-financial. Now, it's not entirely clear that preventing that sort of competition is a good thing. Our assumption in the United States, at least in the Bank Holding Company Act, is that the restrictions are necessary, but as I mentioned before, not everyone agrees with this model. I should also mention in passing that in this lecture, I am discussing our structure of regulation for bank holding companies only. If you read through the materials in Chapter 4 carefully, you will see that there are other depository institutions in the United States, in particular thrift institutions, which have holding companies and have a much laxer regulatory environment. Commercial firms can, and in the United States do occasionally, acquire thrift institutions, specialized types of depository institutions, and the ban on commercial affiliations does not apply in that area. There are those, particularly in the banking industry, that would like to see that loophole, as it's sometimes referred to, closed, but it has been in existence for a number of years without any apparent adverse consequences. There are also, even within the Bank Holding Company Act, a number of relatively narrow exceptions which allow affiliations between certain commercial firms and certain banks. And again, these have existed without apparent problems for a number of years. So in the United States, our system of separating commerce and finance is not airtight. The dominant structure is the one that I have described. By far, the majority of our important banking institutions are regulated in the way that I have described, but there are also exceptions within our regulatory system. While we're discussing activities restrictions, I'd like to also call your attention to a related problem that is quite topical within the United States right now and may be of interest to some members of the class. And that question is the relationship of the restrictions we're discussing to bank subsidiaries. This is an issue taken up in the Family Guardian case on pages 294 to 300 of the casebook and in the notes that follow. Essentially, what we've been discussing so far is the basic holding company structure where the affiliate is a sister corporation to the bank. And as I discussed, the current law is that it must be closely related to banking in its activities. There is another organizational form that is possible for expansion, which is what's known as a subsidiary of the bank or a bank subsidiary. Traditionally in the United States, these entities have been used for specialized kinds of banking activities, perhaps mortgage banking or some specialized service which the bank itself could conduct, but for organizational reasons it was thought desirable to be conducted as a subsidiary of the corporation, of the bank. A number of years ago, the question arose, well, what if the subsidiary of the bank were to engage in non-banking activities? And in particular, in the Family Guardian case, one of our largest bank holding companies, Citicorp, proposed to engage in certain insurance activities, which it could not have conducted at the affiliate level because the activities were considered to be not closely related to banking. And what followed was a considerable amount of litigation. And the litigation considered the question of whether the bank holding company activity restrictions that we've just been discussing applied to non-bank subsidiaries of banks. Now, in a decision which I think is probably more complex than you need to deal with, the Second Circuit Court of Appeals concluded that the Bank Holding Company Act did not in fact apply to what's known as downstream subsidiaries of banks. It only applied upstream to the holding company and across to sister corporations. So this potentially made bank subsidiaries a possible forum for activity expansion into other financial areas and even potentially commercial areas. In the early 1990s, there was a series of responses, both at the congressional level and at the regulatory level, and the expansion was halted for some time, but the general question has been left open as to the extent to which downstream affiliates should be allowed to engage in non-banking style activities. And in the United States right now, there is currently this debate that is going on in Congress, and actually is probably the most controversial part of legislation at the congressional level right now, about where appropriate expansion should be. There are those who are represented by the Federal Reserve Board that think that bank expansion into other non-banking activities should be exclusively at the affiliate level. And there are those led by the Comptroller of the Currency, which is the primary regulator for national banks, that believe that banking organizations should have the choice between expanding in affiliates through the holding company structure or expanding through so-called downstream subsidiaries. Now, this is an interesting question, and it's colored heavily by the regulatory agencies that are involved. It just so happens that both agencies are advocating expansion where they have themselves jurisdiction, and that explains part of the debate. But there is actually an interesting and complicated set of issues about whether one form of expansion is better than the other. As we've discussed, the reasons for regulating activities restrictions in the holding company structure generally have to do with competitive concerns, risk concerns, externalities. And while there are minor variations in how these considerations apply in the different contexts, I think it's fair to say that there's no clear answer which approach is better. One, you might think that in a certain sense, having activities at the upstream holding company level and affiliate level are better because they're further away from the bank in some sense, and the bank might be less tempted to subsidize upstream affiliates than they would downstream affiliates, and that possibly has some merit to it. On the other hand, to the extent that the bank is transferring extra value downstream to subsidiaries where the bank retains ownership and retains control, at least that economic value is staying in some sense within the bank's ownership structure. It becomes an asset of the bank if the value is transferred down. If value is transferred up and over to affiliates, there is the risk that that value will never return to the bank in times of economic turmoil. So there are pros and cons of each regulatory approach. The general consensus in the United States is that banks should have slightly greater latitude to expand in other financial areas. As I mentioned to you, the test for authorized activities of bank holding companies is in the process of being expanded right now. But there's no consensus at this stage about whether or not the expansion should be through affiliates only or through affiliates as well as downstream subsidiaries. Those of you who are interested in this, if you look at the RFI webpage that I maintain at Harvard, there's quite a bit of supplementary material about the legislation pending before Congress at the present time on both the press release section and the supplementary materials section. And I think you'll find more than enough reading there if you wanted to explore this issue further. This brings us to the final issue that I'd like to discuss in today's lecture, the financial obligations of holding companies. However, as I see that we are getting close to, if not beyond, the end of the hour, the way I'd like to deal with this issue is to pose a question for you all by way of an assignment, and I'd like, and as many of you as have time, to respond to this question on the discussion group for today's lecture. The issue that I want to consider is the financial obligations of holding companies to affiliated banks. And this is a topic that is touched upon on pages 305 to 310 of the casebook. So those of you who have not had a chance to do so, I would suggest you take a look at these pages. But what I'd like you to consider is the extent to which holding companies should be required to bail out, that is, provide financial assistance to affiliated banks in times of financial difficulty. This is an issue that has been of some controversy in the United States over the years, and there have been various rules proposed, and our statutory structure includes a combination of those proposals in its current content that deal with this basic problem. And what I want you to consider is it a good idea for these affiliated entities to have a financial obligation to step up to the plate in times of financial crisis? Now, you should know, or you should recall, in thinking about this problem, that the general rule, at least in the United States, is that equity investments in subsidiaries are so-called limited liability investments. Ordinary holding companies are not required to subsidize their subsidiary institutions in the absence of some express additional contractual arrangement if those subsidiaries get into trouble. So in the ordinary case, a holding company or an individual shareholder has no obligation for the liabilities of its subsidiaries in the absence of extra arrangements. And the question I want you for you to consider is whether this rule should be different in the context of regulated entities such as banks and some of the other firms that we'll be looking at in this course. But for purposes of the current exercise, just consider the problem in the context of banks. Would it be a good idea? What are the advantages? What are the disadvantages? What regulatory structure would you recommend in this regard? I will look forward to your comments on this issue over the next week, and I'd like to thank you again for your attention. This is the end of lecture number 7 in our series on the regulation of financial institutions. Next week, we will turn to the general problem of dealing with failed depository institutions in the United States, which is the subject matter of Chapter 5. As you'll see, if you flipped ahead in the casebook, Chapter 5 is rather extensive, so I will be just pulling out some selected topics that I think will be of interest in that chapter, and I will post on the syllabus and assignment sheet the readings that I will be emphasizing. So that's the end of this hour. I hope you've enjoyed the lecture, and I look forward to meeting with you again next week.